She also did some groundwork in regards of being an independent producer, record company boss, distributor, whatever. So she's absolutely independent there. You have your own record label too. Was she kind of a model, or were you there with your record company even earlier than she was?
I started my company in 1990, so I don't know.
You were there earlier.
The model for me was that I wanted to put other people's records out, not my own, because I sort of looked at the situation of, like, me and Emily were on a major, and it gave me an opportunity to have access to more money, actually. And the first thing I did was start my own label. And my plan was to put 5 records out a year by other people and eventually put my own record out, which I did. So, but Ani's definitely someone I've called a lot about distribution problems or just anything business related. I'll call her and just be like, I need your help. What should I do about this? You got any ideas? She's got a great business model. She's helped some of my artists out. I have an artist named Danielle Howell, who Ani heard and then took her on the road as an opening band for a while, and it really helped me, you know, develop that artist. And so, yeah, there's some cross-pollination there. But we sort of, you know, she started putting other people's records out now, so we sort of started the right opposite way. So.
So was it difficult to start the company, even with the extra money you had from your record label deal?
It was a lot easier, actually, than I thought it would be. The biggest problem back then is the biggest problem now, which is keeping distribution straight and staying with a distributor that doesn't go bankrupt. You know, I started out with Rough Trade, and their distribution system in the States went bankrupt, and so I had to find a new one. And I've landed on one that I really like now, but it took me quite a long time, and it was so hard to keep up with American that I could never go beyond that, really, and try to license over in Europe. Just, I mean, I'm working on it now with my own thing, getting a license for some stuff, but it's just running a label is, yeah, it takes a lot of work. So it's not as much, I mean, the money, I always lose money, but, you know, it's more of a non-profit kind of situation. So that doesn't bother me as much. It's just the frustration with the American corporate music system and just how to get your artist in it and how to get their records into the stores. And
but Damon Records is strictly your leg. It's not connected with Indigo Girls.
No, except that Emily, you know, helps a lot because we take a lot of my artists on the road with us. So, you know, there's that. That's the connection. But no, yeah, it's just my little baby. I have 3 people that work for me, and we have a very separate life from Indigo Girls.
How big an organization is the Indigo Girls? Like, you definitely need a few people who work for you on all kinds of levels.
Yeah. We have a manager, and we have an assistant. There's like 3 or 4 people in the office, but they manage other people too, so it's not that big of an organization. Mm-hmm. We have a crew that fluctuates between 3 to 10, 12 people, depending on whether with a band or not. So we're pretty organic, honestly.
Sounds like
no frills. But we have a booking agent and a financial manager, things like that, but it's not a huge organization.
Yeah. We were talking about the cassette and the EP and the single. Strange Fire was the first long-playing album, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's still available, I think. It was re-released in
89. Yeah, there's a couple changes. We took off High Horse. We took off a song that was originally on there, and then we put a different version of Land of Canaan, or was that the only change that we just took off High Horse?
I think that was the only change. Land of Canaan, the other version, was on the first Indigo Girl record.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it was acquired by Epic and then re-released a little bit different.
You did that the first time in 87, I think, was the first time it came out.
Yeah,
you did
the
it all by
Strange
yourself?
Fire. Yeah, we went to Athens and worked in a guy's studio named John Keane. And, just did it all ourselves.
Released it ourselves and promoted it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then actually we had booked studio time to go make our second full-length LP when we got signed to Epic Records.
How did that come about, the connection to Epic Records?
They used to have a college radio, it was CBS Records then, and they had a college radio department, and we had a friend, Tom Simonson, who got a tape of ours onto the desk of Roger Klein, who was an A&R guy for Epic. And I think Roger was out pursuing other things.
R.E.M.
Was it specifically R.E.M.? You know, Athens being an hour and 15 minutes away or whatever, so he just came down, and Roger's kind of a eccentric guy with sort of eclectic taste, and he liked our stuff, and he came to hear us play, and he was really the main guy behind it, you know. His boss liked us as well, but it wasn't like there was no bidding war. Epic was really the only one really interested in us, and it was the right time and the right guy.
Mm. Was it all like a straight thing, that like it happened in a straight way without any trouble in between? Or were things like the aspect that you're gay, was that an important aspect in the whole thing, like getting the whole thing rolling with the company back then?
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, believe it or not, it wasn't even an issue. Mm-hmm. No one talked about it. Mm-hmm.
We see the issues now, looking back, and what you struggle in, you know, especially in radio world, or where the record company doesn't know how to promote outspoken lesbian sort of alternative artists. There's no way to really market them. We don't fit into anything. And then, you know, the discomfort of a male-dominated, corporately run radio world and things like that. So we can see what's happening now. But at the beginning, it wasn't like it was an obstacle to us getting signed or doing our own thing, for that matter.
But then on the other hand, you're not writing like songs that are very out there, very much confronting people with this aspect. Just these are songs that I find that you're writing that quite everybody can relate to, right? Is that some kind of policy that you have there between you? Like you say, well, we want to have a possibility that everybody really can relate to our feelings and emotions and thoughts.
It's not a policy. I mean, when we started, you know, our politics weren't as articulated in a lot of ways, actually, at the beginning. Like when we first got signed, we weren't even as politicized. I mean, we were political and to a certain degree, but we didn't articulate it the same way. And as we've been on the label longer, we've actually started writing stuff that might be more confrontational, and our sales have gone down. So there's definitely a connection there. But it's not a policy, but I think as songwriters, we probably both think about, I mean, I do anyway, when I write a song, I don't want to alienate somebody, but I think about how to get it out of my introspective, just insular world into this greater world at large and how to do that, you know, but I don't ever censor myself as to how I relate to things. But I think of sexuality as being so fluid sometimes that I would hope people can, you can write about a lover that's a woman or a man and have it be something that people can relate to the idea of love rather than, or the problems that are inherent in that. But, you know, being gay definitely informs what we do. It can't help but inform it because we are in a oppressive, you know, system still. And so it probably does affect the way we live or the way we run our business or the way we write a song. But it doesn't, we don't feel like we can't write about certain things or we don't want to alienate our audience or anything like that. I think it's a question of how good, just we want to write a good song. Political things are harder to write about sometimes too, you know. I mean, it's hard to write a song that's not preachy or dogmatic, you know, and it takes a real talent to lyrically to capture something politically, I think. So we might tend to do less of that sometimes.
We don't have that much time left, so we should rush over to the next song.
Yeah, okay. Speaking of politics.
Queen Latifah.
Yeah. She's one of my favorites. She's just a strong woman. She's trying to break down the objectification of women. I mean, it's amazing the success that she's had given the world that she's in. There's a lot of misogyny in rap music, and she's just a strong woman figure, and she just got the groove and the flow. I love her.